Beckett said all letters must go to him first so he could sort them out.
Since when?
Since right about Christmas last, sir. Mr. Beckett said His Grace didn't like too many letters begging him for charity.
What?
Camden almost said the word aloud.
His father had never met a beggar for whom he didn't have a coin to spare. It was his very soft-heartedness that had in part made them paupers. An appalling suspicion was beginning to coalesce in Camden's mind. He wanted to bat it away with something heavy and powerful, a club, a mace, to disperse the filaments of deductions and inferences that threatened to choke his perfect contentment. He wanted to forget what he had heard about the majordomo just now, ignore the clamour in his head that had risen to a screaming siren, and pretend that everything was exactly as it should be. Tomorrow he was getting married. He couldn't wait to sleep with that girl. He couldn't wait to wake up next to her every day, bask in her adoration and delight in her verve.
"Very well, take these to Beckett," he said.
"Yes, sir."
Camden watched the footman march down the hallway.
"Let him go. Let him go. Don't ask questions. Don't think. Don't probe."
"Wait," he commanded.
Elwood turned around obediently.
"Yes, sir."
"Tell Beckett I would like to see him in my apartment in 15 minutes.
Chapter 11. The 22nd of May, 1893. A gentleman's club had seemed the perfect remedy after a tiring week-long business trip to the continent, during which he'd thought very little of his business and too much of his wife. But Camden was beginning to regret his freshly minted membership. He had never set foot inside an English gentleman's club before, but he had harboured the distinct impression that it would be a quiet, calm place, filled with men escaping the strictures of wives and hearths, drinking scotch, holding desultory political debates, and snoring softly into their copies of the Times. Certainly the interior of the club, which looked as if it hadn't been touched in half a century, fading burgundy drapes, wallpaper splotchily darkened by gaslights, and furnishing that in another decade or so would be called genteelly shabby, had seemed conducive to somnolence, giving him the false hope that he'd be able to while away the afternoon, brooding in peace. And he had done so for a few minutes, until a crowd begging for introductions surrounded him. The conversation had quickly turned to Camden's various holdings. He hadn't quite believed Mrs. Rowland when she declared in one of her letters that society had changed and that people couldn't shut up about money these days. Now he did.
"How much would such a yacht cost?" asked one eager young man.
"Is there a sizeable profit to be realized?" asked another.
Perhaps the agricultural depression that had cut many a large estate's income by half had something to do with it. The aristocracy was in a pinch. The manor, the carriages, and the servants all bled money, which was getting scarcer by the day. Unemployment, for centuries the gentlemanly standard, so that one could devote one's time to serving as parliamentarian and magistrate, was becoming more and more of an untenable position. But as of yet, few gentlemen had the audacity to work. So they talked, to scratch the itch of collective anxiety.
"Such a yacht costs enough that only a handful of America's richest men can afford one," Camden said. "But, alas, not so much that those who supply them can claim instant riches."
If he were to solely rely on the firm he owned that designed and built yachts, he'd be a well-off man, but nowhere near wealthy enough to hobnob with Manhattan's elite. It was his other maritime ventures, the freight shipping line and the shipyard that built commercial vessels, that comprised what Americans called the meat and potato portion of his portfolio.
"How does one come into possession of such a firm?" asked yet another man from the group of interlocutors, this one not as young as the others, and, judging by his silhouette, sporting a corset beneath his waistcoat.
Camden glanced toward the grandfather clock that stood between two bookshelves against the far wall. Whatever the time was, he was going to say that he was expected elsewhere in half an hour. The time was 3:15, and beside the clock stood Lord Renworth, observing the mob about Camden with amusement.
"How?" Camden looked back at the corseted man. "Good luck, good timing, and a wife who is worth her weight in gold, my dear fellow."
His answer was received with a silence halfway between shock and awe. He took the opportunity to stand up.
"Excuse me, gentlemen, I'd like to have a word with Lord Renworth."
He remembered. "My daughter sends me postcards from the Lake District. I hear Lord Renworth is also there."
"My daughter is going to Scotland with a large party of friends, Lord Renworth included, for a se'nnight."
"My daughter, when I last saw her at dinner, sported a fetching pair of diamond bracelets that I'd never seen before. She was unusually coy about their provenance."
Mrs. Rowland had been overly lavish in her praise of Lord Renworth. "A man all men want to be and all women want to bewitch. But not by much. The man seemed effortlessly graceful, effortlessly fashionable, and effortlessly calm and collected."
"Quite a crowd you are drawing, my Lord Tremaine," Lord Renworth said with a smile as he and Camden shook hands. "You are an object of great curiosity around these parts."
"Ah, yes, the latest addition to the circus, etc.," said Camden. "You, sir, are fortunate to be so well situated that you need not soil your mind with thoughts of commerce."
Lord Renworth laughed.
"As to that, my lord, you are very much mistaken. Rich peers need money every bit as much as poor peers. We have far greater expenditures. But I dare say your material success fuels only part of the collective curiosity. Let me guess, there's that little matter of the divorce. Short of a good old-fashioned murder, a divorce with charges of adultery levelled is the best anyone can hope for when the mood calls for some entertaining gossip."
"Indeed, what have you heard?"
Lord Renworth raised an eyebrow, but proceeded to answer Camden's question.
"I'm blessed with a battalion of sisters-in-law. One, with impeccable sources, declares that you're willing to submit to an annulment should Lady Tremaine hand over half her worth and promise to travel to her honeymoon destination on your flagship luxury liner."
"Interesting. I don't deal in passenger transit."
"You must be mistaken," said Lord Renworth. "Though, to be sure, another one of Lady Renworth's sisters, with sources equally infallible, insists that you're a hairbreadth away from a grand reconciliation."
Camden nodded.
"And you are in favour of the old status quo. Lady Tremaine is quite peeved with you, I might as well let you know. She thought you'd be a better friend to Lord Frederick."
"Then that would make me less of a friend to her," said Lord Renworth, no longer glib.
"Lord Frederick, though he is a man of unimpeachable goodness, speak of the devil. The rumour-mongers will have new tales to tell tonight."
He pointed his chin toward the door. Camden turned to see a young man coming toward them. Though he stooped slightly, he was still tall, a hair under 6 foot. He had a round face, a firm jaw, and clear, uncomplicated eyes. Elsewhere in the room, men stopped what they were doing and stared openly at his progress, glancing from Camden to him and back. but he remained oblivious to the attraction he had become. The young man offered his hand to Lord Renworth.
"Lord Ren, pleased to meet you."
He had a melodious, surprisingly basso profundo voice.
"Was just thinking of sending a note around. Lady Ren asked me a couple of months ago if I would paint a portrait of her. Well, I told her that I wasn't much good at portraits, but these days, well, you know what's going on. I seem to have lots of time on my hands, if she's still interested."
"I'm sure she would be delighted, Freddy," Lord Renworth said smoothly. He turned to Camden. "Lord Tremaine, may I present Lord Frederick Stuart? Freddy, Lord Tremaine." Camden extended his hand.
"A pleasure, sir."
Lord Frederick blinked. He stared at Camden for a second, as if expecting something dire. Then he swallowed and grasped Camden's hand with his own, which was large and slightly plump.
"Righto. Pleased, I'm sure, my lord."
For some reason, despite everything Mrs. Rowland had written, Camden had expected to see a prime specimen of a man. Lord Frederick was not that man. Next to Lord Renworth, he seemed all too ordinary, his looks pleasant but unremarkable, his attire a year or two behind the forefront of fashion, his demeanour unsophisticated.
"You are an artist, Lord Frederick?"
"No, no, I only dabble."
"Nonsense," said Lord Renworth. "Lord Frederick is tremendously accomplished for his age."
His age? Yet something else Camden hadn't expected. Lord Frederick could not have lived through more than 24 winters, a mere babe, barely old enough to grow hairs on his chin.
"Lord Renworth is much too kind," Lord Frederick mumbled.
Camden could see he was beginning to sweat, despite the cool interior of the club.
"I beg to differ," said Renworth. "I have one of Freddy's pieces at home. Lady Renworth quite admires it. In fact, I believe Lady..."
Suddenly Lord Frederick looked quite panic-stricken.
"Ren!"
Lord Renworth was taken aback.
"Yes, Freddy?"
Lord Frederick could not come up with a slick answer.
I forgot."
"What were you about to say, my Lord Renworth?" Camden asked.
"Only that I believe my mother-in-law begged to have it," said Lord Renworth. "But Lady Renworth refused to part with it."
"Oh,"
said Lord Frederick, turning a shade of carmine to rival the drapes. The two older men exchanged a look. Lord Renworth shrugged subtly, as if he had no idea as to the reason behind Lord Frederick's outburst. But Camden had already guessed.
"Is Lady Tremaine, like Lady Renworth, an admirer of your work, Lord Frederick?"
Lord Frederick looked to Lord Renworth for recourse, but the latter chose not to involve himself, leaving Lord Frederick to meet Camden's direct question by himself.
Lady Tremaine has always been most kind to my efforts. She's a great collector of art."
Not something Camden would have said about his wife, but he supposed it was possible that, in a society enamoured of the classical styles and subjects of Sir Frederick Leighton and Lawrence Alma Tadema, she could very well host one of the largest collections of Impressionist paintings.
"You approve of the latest trends in art, I take it?"
"I do, sir, indeed." Lord Frederick relaxed slightly.
"Then you must come see me the next time you happen to be in New York City. My collection is far superior to Lady Tremaine's, at least in quantity." The poor boy clearly struggled, wondering whether he was being played for a fool. But he chose to answer Camden's invitation as if it had been issued in good faith.
"I shall be honoured, sir."
In that moment, Camden saw what Gigi must have seen in the boy. His goodness, his sincerity, his willingness to think the best of everyone he met, a willingness that arose less from naivete than from an inborn sweetness. Lord Frederick hesitated.
"Would you be returning to America very soon, or would you be with us for a while?"
And courage, too, to ask that question outright of him.
"I expect I shall remain in London until the matter of my divorce is settled."
Lord Frederick's blush now exceeded Hungarian paprika in depth of colour and vividness. Lord Renworth took his watch out and glanced at it.
"Dear me, I should have met Lady Renworth at the bookshop 5 minutes ago. You must excuse me, gentlemen. Hell hath no fury like a woman made to wait."
To Lord Frederick's credit, he didn't run, though his desire to do so was writ plain on his face. Camden gazed around the large common room. Newspapers suddenly rustled, conversations recommenced. Cigars that had been dropping ashes on the scarlet and blue carpet rose once again to moustached lips. Satisfied that the rampant, untoward curiosity in the room had been temporarily curbed, Camden returned his attention to Lord Frederick.
"I understand that you wish to marry my wife."
The colour drained from Lord Frederick's face, but he stood his ground.
"I do."
"Why?"
"I love her."
Camden had no choice but to believe him. Lord Frederick's answer brimmed with the kind of clarity born of the deepest conviction. He ignored the stab of pain in his chest.
"Other than that?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"Love is an unreliable emotion. What is it about Lady Tremaine that makes you think you won't regret marrying her?"
Lord Frederick swallowed.
"She's kind, wise, and courageous. She understands the world, but doesn't let it corrupt her. She is magnificent. She is like...
He was lost for words.
"Like the sun in the sky," Camden prompted, sighing inwardly.
"Yes, exactly," said Lord Frederick. How did you guess, sir?"
He thought, "because I once thought the same, and sometimes still think it." "Luck," answered Camden. "Tell me, young man, have you ever considered that it might not be easy being married to a woman like that?"
Lord Frederick looked perplexed, like a child being told that there was such a thing as too much ice cream, when he had only ever been allowed a few spoonfuls at a time.
"How so?"
Camden shook his head. What could he say?
"Do not mind the rambling of an old man." He offered his hand again. "I wish you the best of luck."
"Thank you, sir."
Lord Frederick sounded both relieved and grateful.
"Thank you. I wish you the same."
"May the better man prevail."
The reply rose nearly to the tip of Camden's tongue before he realized what he was about to say and swallowed it whole.
He couldn't possibly have meant anything close to that. He couldn't possibly even have thought it. He had no use for her. He didn't want her back. It was but the flotsam of his psyche, washed ashore in a sudden surge of masculine possessiveness.
He nodded at Lord Frederick and a few other men, retrieved his hat and walking stick, and exited the club into the midst of a fine afternoon. It was all wrong. The sky should be ominous, the wind cold, the rain fierce. He would have welcomed that, welcomed the drenching discomfort and isolation of an icy downpour. Instead, he must endure the mercilessly beautiful sunshine of an early summer day, and listen to birds chirp and children laugh as all his carefully constructed rationales threatened to crumble about him. She was wrong. It wasn't about Theodora. It had never been about Theodora. It was always about her.
Gigi was giving Victoria trouble.
"Duke of Perrin?" she frowned. "How do you know him?"
This was not the reaction Victoria had expected from Gigi. She had mentioned the Duke only most incidentally, while trying to persuade Gigi to take some time away from London. "He happens to be my neighbour. We met on one of his daily walks."
"I'm surprised you allowed him to introduce himself to you."
A maid in a white shirt, black skirts, and a long bib apron came by and filled their glasses with mineral water. Victoria had arranged for them to meet at a ladies' tea shop. She didn't trust Gigi's servants not to gossip.
"I thought you usually stayed well away from cads and roues."
"Cads and roues?" Victoria cried. "What does that have to do with His Grace? He's very well respected, I will have you know." "He had a near-fatal hunting accident some 15 years ago. After that, he retired from society, and I will have you know that until then he was the veriest lecher, gambler, and all-around reprobate." Victoria dabbed at her upper lip with her napkin to hide her wide-open mouth. The Duke had been her neighbour in her youth, and he was her neighbour now. But she had to admit that she had no idea what he had done with himself during the 20-odd years in the middle.
"Well, he can't be any worse than Carrington, can he?"
"Carrington?" Gigi stared at her. "Why are you comparing him to Carrington? Are you thinking of marrying him?"
"No, of course not," Victoria denied hotly.
The next instant she wished she hadn't, because Gigi's eyes narrowed with suspicion.
"Then what are you doing inviting him to dinner?"
Her voice turned chillier with every word.
"Tell me you aren't planning some lunacy to make me into the next Duchess of Perrin."
Victoria sighed.
"It can't hurt, can it?"
"Mother, I believe I have told you already that I'm going to marry Lord Frederick Stuart once I'm divorced from Tremaine." Gigi spoke slowly, as if to a very dull child.
"But you won't be divorced for a while yet," Victoria pointed out reasonably. "Your feelings for Lord Frederick might very well have changed by then."
"Are you calling me fickle?"
"No, no, of course not."
Oh, dear, however did one explain to a girl that her intended had less brains than a chipmunk?
"I'm only saying that, well, I don't think Lord Frederick is the best man for you."
"He is a good, gentle and kind man of absolutely no vices. He loves me very much. What other man could be better for me?"
Crumbs, the girl was daring her. "You must consider this carefully. You are a clever woman. Can you really respect a man who does not possess the same perspicuity?
Why don't you just come out and say you think he's dense?"
"Oh, stupid girl."
"All right. I think he is dense. Denser than Nesselrod pudding. And I can't stand the thought of you being married to him. He's not good enough to carry your shoes."
Gigi stood up calmly. "It is good to see you, Mother. I wish you a pleasant stay in London, but I regret I cannot come to Devon next week, the week after, or the week after that. Good day."
Victoria resisted the urge to put her face into her hands. She was bewildered. She had been so careful not to mention Camden or to criticize Gigi on the petition for divorce. And now she couldn't state the obvious concerning Lord Frederick either.
Gigi arrived home fuming. What was wrong with her mother? A millennium had passed since Gigi had come to see the utter meaninglessness of a title. But still, Mrs. Rowland cleaved to the illusion that a strawberry leaf coronet cured all ills. She went in search of Croesus. Nothing and no one soothed her the way Croesus did, with his patient understanding and constant affection. But Croesus was neither in her bedchamber nor in the kitchen, where he occasionally went when his appetite returned. Suddenly she felt a shiver of fear.
"Where's Croesus?" she asked Goodman. "Is he—"
No, madam, he's well. I believe he's with Lord Tremaine in the conservatory.
So Camden had come back from wherever he had been the past week. Very good. I'll go rescue him. The conservatory stretched nearly the entire width of the house. From the outside, it was an oasis of verdancy, even on the dreariest days of winter. The vines and fern fronds weaving a green cascade through the clear glass walls. From the inside, the structure offered an unimpeded view of the street beneath and the park beyond. Camden sat sprawled on a wicker chair at the far end of the conservatory, his arms stretched over the back of the chair, his stockinged feet propped up on a wicker ottoman before him. Croesus lay snoozing next to him. Camden had his profile to her, that strong, flawless profile that had so reminded her of a statue of Apollo Belvedere. He glanced away from the open windows at the sound of her approach, but he did not rise. "My Lady Tremaine," he said with mock courtesy. She ignored him, scooped up Croesus, who wriggled and snorted, then settled into the crook of her elbow and went on with his nap, and turned to leave. "I was introduced to Lord Frederick earlier this afternoon at the club," said her husband. "It was an edifying encounter." She whipped around. "Let me guess, you found him to possess all the intelligence of a boiled egg." Let him dare to agree with her. She was quite in the mood for slapping someone. Him.
"I did not find him either eloquent or worldly, but that was not the thrust of my remark."
"What was the thrust of your remark, then?" she asked, suspicious.
"That he would make some woman an excellent husband. He is sincere, steadfast, and loyal."
She was stunned.
"Thank you."
His gaze returned to the outside world. A pleasant breeze invaded the conservatory, ruffling his thick, straight hair. Carriages on exodus from the park crammed the street below. The air echoed with coachmen's calls, cautioning their horses and one another to pay heed to the logjam. Apparently their little exchange was over. But Camden's remarkable compliment to Freddy had bred an opportunity that she could not let pass.
"Would you do the honourable deed and release me from this marriage? I love Freddy, and he loves me. Let us marry while we're still young enough to forge a life together."
In his perfect stillness, she sensed a sudden stiffening.
"Please," she said slowly, "I beg you, release me."
His gaze remained fixed on the daily tide of phaetons and barouches, of England's vanity and pride on parade.
"I didn't say he would make you a good husband."
"And what would you know about making anyone a good husband?"
She regretted the words as soon as they left her lips, but there was no taking them back now.
"Absolutely nothing," he admitted without hesitation. "But at least I saw a few of your faults. I thought you interesting and appealing in spite of them, or perhaps because of them. Lord Frederick worships the ground you walk on, because you have the kind of strength, resilience, and nerve he can only dream of. When he looks at you, he sees only the halo he has erected about you."
"What's wrong with being perfect in the eyes of my beloved?"
His eyes locked with hers.
"I look at him and I see a man who thinks we are going to be as chaste as God and Mary in this house. Does he know you're protecting him from the truth? Does he know that a few big lies in the service of love are nothing to you? That your strength extends to remorseless ruthlessness?"
She'd have spat on the floor if she hadn't been raised by Victoria Rowland.
"I look at you and I see a man who is still stuck in 1883. Does he know that 10 years have passed? Does he know that I have moved on? That he is the relentless, ruthless one now?
And does he really think I plan to tell the man I love that I'm to be impregnated by another against my wish?
Someone laughed in the distance, a shrill, feminine giggle. Croesus whimpered and shifted in her arms. She was crushing him with the stiffness of her grip. She let out a shaky breath and forced her muscles to relax. He pressed two fingertips to his right temple.
"You make it sound so ugly, my dear. Don't you think I deserve to get something out of this marriage before you traipse into your happily ever after?"
"I don't know," she said, "and I don't care. All I know is that Freddy is my last chance for happiness in this life. I will marry him if I have to turn into Lady Macbeth and destroy all who stand in my path."
His eyes narrowed. They were the dark green of a nightmare forest. "Warming up to your old tricks."
"How can I fail to be unscrupulous when you keep reminding me that I am?"
Her heart was a swamp of bitterness at him, at herself.
"We will begin our 1 year tonight. Not later, not whenever you finally feel like it. Tonight. And I don't give a halfpenny if you have to spend the rest of the night puking."
He merely smiled.
Chapter 12, January 1883. Beckett, 12 Pillars Majordomo, was a man in his early 50s, tall, thin, and balding. Camden found him highly efficient, despite his occasional unctuousness. Presumably Carrington had liked his servants obsequious.
"You wish to see me, Lord Tremaine?" asked Beckett.
Without speaking, Camden motioned the majordomo to sit. He himself remained standing. The older man settled uneasily into the indicated chair. Camden stared at him, because he wasn't yet sure where to begin, and because he wished to intimidate. After 20 seconds, Beckett had trouble meeting his eyes. After 3 minutes, he was fidgeting and surreptitiously wiping away at his forehead and upper lip.
"You do know, Beckett, that abusing your employer's trust is a crime punishable by law, don't you?"
Beckett's head snapped up. For a moment, his expression was one of sheer panic. But he hadn't risen to be the head of staff in a ducal household without having learned a thing or two about self-control. In the next second, he replied in a normal voice,
"Of course, my lord, I'm more than aware loyalty's my creed."
But his fear-stricken look had already given too much away. He was guilty.
But of what?
"I admire your composure, Beckett. It must not be easy to appear calm when you're quaking in your shoes."
I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about, sir."
"I think you do, Beckett, and I think you are filled with dismay, horror, and, I hope, some shame at being found out. If I were you, I wouldn't carry this protestation of innocence any further. If you would not admit your errors to me in private, I shall be forced to go to His Grace and expose your lies. Then he would have no choice but to call in the constables."
Beckett was not about to give up easily. "Sir, if I've done something that has displeased you, please let me know what it is."
Therein lay the difficulty of the matter. Camden had nothing concrete against Beckett, only the knowledge that Beckett had disrupted the usual pattern of mail delivery within the house, and that Camden had a letter from Theodora that he was beginning to believe wasn't from Theodora at all. God help him. He walked to the mantel and pretended to study the framed seascape above it. If there was any link between Beckett and Theodora's letter, it was only an indirect one. He was acting at someone else's behest, a paid agent. Camden turned around and bluffed. "I know why you have all the mail delivered to you first. You see, Beckett, I have bad news for you. Your puppeteer has no more use for you,
and doesn't care to pay the remainder of your fee, so he has decided to throw you to the wolves.
No! Beckett bolted out of the chair. The bastard!
His ragged breathing suffused the stillness of the room. Then, realizing he had completely given himself away, he sank down into the chair and lowered his face into his palms.
Forgive me, my lord, but I've not done anything. Nothing, I swear. I was told only to watch out for any letters that came for you from abroad. Those I was to hand to the man. But he never took one of them either. He just looked at them and gave them back to me.
Any letter that came for him from abroad. Camden felt something implode in his chest, as if his lungs had collapsed.
Are you sure you've done nothing?
There, Beckett wiped his face with his handkerchief.
There was this one time in the beginning when the man gave me back the letters and I was sure one of them hadn't been there earlier.
One letter. That was all it took. One letter.
Where and when do you meet this man?
Outside the gate, on Tuesday and Friday afternoons.
And what if you can't meet him in person for some reason?
Then I'm to wrap the letters carefully and place the package under a rock by the gooseberry bush to the left of the gate. He comes at 3. Today was Friday. The time was 25 minutes before 3.
Too bad, Camden said. I imagine he will not come any more, or I could have him thrown in jail also.
Beckett paled.
But, my lord, you said...
I know what I said. I expect your resignation to be handed in to His Grace tomorrow after dinner.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Beckett all but kissed Camden's feet.
Go.
As Beckett made his unsteady way to the door, Camden remembered one last thing.
How much were you paid up front?
Beckett hesitated.
£2,000. I have a natural son, my lord. He's in trouble. I used the money to pay off his debts. I will restitute it to you as soon as I may.
Camden pressed his fingers hard against his temple.
I don't want it, and I don't wish to see you ever again. Leave.
£2,000 up front, £2,000 later.
Who had this kind of money to throw away? And why would anyone want to do it?
All the evidence pointed to only one direction, but he couldn't bear to acknowledge it. Perhaps, he prayed, perhaps he was wrong. Perhaps the fear that knotted his guts wasn't a sign of inevitability, but only a result of his overactive imagination. Perhaps there was still hope. 2.5 hours later, there was no longer any possibility of denial. Camden wrapped the 2 letters from his friends, hid them as Beckett had done, and waited. A man did come, a raffish-looking man in his 60s, in a dog-cart pulled by an ancient nag. He looked around carefully, then went for the gooseberry bush. As Beckett had described, he quickly glanced over the letters, then put them back where he'd found them. The man manoeuvred the dog-cart around and started back the way he'd come. Camden followed at a distance, on foot, the pain in his chest growing more vicious with every passing mile, all the way to the bitter end, as the man and his cart disappeared between the gates of Briar Meadow, the chimneys of his fiancée's house just visible in the fading light above the tops of the naked poplars. Something shriveled and died in him. He began to walk, then run away from Briar Meadow, away from her. Gigi, lovely, treacherous Gigi. Was it only this morning that he had come this way, as eager to please and impress her as any stupid puppy that ever lived? He didn't know how far or how long he sprinted,
or at what point he finally crumpled to the ground, his eyes dry, his mind numb, except for a splitting headache, the anvils of Lucifer beating every last shred of illusion out of him. She had done it. For some reason, she had decided that she must have him. So she'd had the letter forged. Of course it was her. She was by far the most devious person he'd ever come across. And he, horny fool that he was, had played along ever so willingly. How immeasurable her satisfaction must have been to see him this morning, knowing that her victory was complete and that he'd melt in her hand as readily as a piece of suet. Anger, burning, icy, dark as the pits of hell, rose slowly in him until degree by degree it had taken over every cell of his body. He clung to that anger, for it dispelled pain and kept it at bay. Vengeance. He would have vengeance. She was willing to shell out £4,000 for him, was she? Then the lady mustn't be disappointed. She would see that he was every bit her equal in duplicity and heartlessness. He pried himself off the ground and went on running, not stopping again until he was in view of 12 Pillars. A stray thought wrestled free from his tight control as he marched toward the house. It pined over how close to paradise he'd come, how joyful and carefree he had been only hours ago. It wanted time to turn back, and Aunt Plony to never have come. It wanted to beat the walls and wail, "Gigi, you stupid, stupid girl, why couldn't you have waited? Theodora got married today. Today! I would have been..." "Shut up! Shut up! I will shoot you myself if you ever whine for that girl again." Vengeance, he thought. Remember, only vengeance.
Chapter 13. The 22nd of May, 1893. Langford was restless. For the past 15 years, his evenings had consisted of dinner, a cigar, the day's copy of the Times, and one last hour of scholarly reading. And for about 13 of those 15 years, twice a week, his current London mistress would arrive just as he laid aside Plato's Symposium or Aeschylus's Myrmidons. The first year after his return to Devonshire, he had tried, without consistent success, to set up a more local arrangement. For the past 12 months or so, he had been celibate. He had never been an advocate for celibacy, nor was he one now. He had, perhaps, simply become too much of a village bumpkin to make the rounds of the London flesh market. Or perhaps he had no more need for the old carnal calisthenics, having grown prematurely asexual via the combination of solitude and scholarly pursuits. And he hadn't missed it terribly. Until tonight. He would not mind knowing that a woman was stepping off the 9:23 train at the town of Totnes at that moment, about to be conveyed 4 miles southeast to Ludlow Court. The tranquillity of his library had become somnolent and tedious. His evening routine, with its careful variety of cigars, punch, and an occasional novel, was as sterile as the capons his cook served on Thursdays. Even having his dessert first tonight had done nothing to alleviate the oppressive sameness, except making him feel acutely ridiculous. The problem wasn't lethargy, which afflicted him from time to time. Rather, he suffered from a surfeit of energy. He was pacing like a wind-up Christmas toy soldier under the generalship of a 3-year-old boy. A knock came at the library door. His butler, Reeves, entered, bearing the Evening Post. Langford scanned the 3 envelopes. 2 were correspondence from other scholars, 1 German, 1 Greek. The last was a letter from his cousin Caroline, otherwise known as Lady Avery,
a woman with a religious passion for the sins of others, and a philanthropist's delight in sharing her encyclopedic knowledge of society's every last tempest in a teapot. He dismissed Reeves and opened Caro's letter, glad for some nonsensical distraction. Caro and her sister Grace, Lady Summersby, used to call on him first thing in the morning to find out from the servants which lady's abode he had visited the night before, or if any Cyprians, the precise number, please, had been brought into his own house. He had personally supervised the accidental dumping of buckets of cold water as they stood before his door one morning, ringing. But their fearsome dedication to their craft was such that they'd returned the next day with umbrellas. Perhaps as a tribute to all the delicious, scandalous titbits he'd provided, which had elevated them to the top of the rumour-mongering pyramid, Caro wrote him every month about the latest on dits. At the beginning of his self-imposed exile, he had tossed the letters unopened into the fire. But as the years went by, her clockwork persistence wore down his resistance. He was ashamed to admit it, but he had become addicted to the monthly dose of adultery, vanity, and lunacy. This month's instalment had Lady Southwell giving birth to yet another child who looked nothing like Lord Southwell, but bore every resemblance to the Honourable Mr. Rumford. Sir Roland George setting up two mistresses in the same house, and Lord Whitney Wilde reputedly being caught with his brother's fiancée in a cupboard. But Caro saved the best for last. An honest-to-goodness divorce, involving not just anyone, but one of the country's richest heiresses and the Duke's heir, said to be worth a mint himself. Caro wrote giddily and at length of the Marchioness's determination to marry her young admirer, the Marquis's cryptic intentions, and the wild conjectures circulating about town concerning the outcome of the case. They had put on a most amicable front before others, but behind closed doors, what was taking place? Were they poisoning each other's coffee? Each spreading false rumours about the other? Or, unlikely but not impossible, sharing a giggle together at the expense of that dunce Lord Frederick Stuart? The railroad heiress, Caro had called the Marchioness of Tremaine. The railroad heiress, who almost married a duke, then managed to marry her dead fiancé's cousin within an indecently short period, but never got to wear a coronet of strawberry leaves. He frowned and suddenly realised where he had seen Mrs. Rowland before. Right there, on that same country lane, before that same cottage. It must have been a good 30 years ago. He had been home on holiday from Eton, bored out of his mind, itching to do something wild and stupid, but not quite wanting the news of it to get back to his parents. His father had been bedridden for several years and would die in a few weeks, but Langford hadn't known that at the time. He resented his sire's interminable and seemingly pointless illness. At school, he could slur against the pall that hung permanently over Ludlow Court by making savage jokes involving his useless father's bodily output and the middle-aged, round-faced nursemaid who handled the effluvia with what he considered obscene good cheer. At home, he had no such recourse. He could only try to distance himself from the house as much and as often as possible. So he undertook long daily walks. And it was on one of those walks that he saw her, emerging from the cottage to a waiting barouche in the lane. She had been jaw-droppingly beautiful. Having lost his virginity a few months before, he considered himself sophisticated. But he gawked. Not only were her features lovely, her figure was divine. She moved with the grace of a nymph and the fluidity of a nereid. A man he thought to be her father climbed into the open carriage after her. But then a second man, grey-haired and stooped, approached the carriage. She leaned out and kissed him on the cheek. "Goodbye, father." She was on his mind quite a bit in the following days. He found out that she was indeed married to someone twice her age, a man who manufactured rails and industrial machinery. A shame, he thought, though why it was a shame he never explored. He certainly had no intention of marrying her, though he would have loved to seduce her. Then his father died, and guilt consumed him. She faded from memory. He embarked on the life of a rogue until he returned to Devon. How long had she been back? They had lived as neighbours for years without the least neighbourly interaction. Until now. Until she'd barged into his path with all the subtlety of an avalanche. He had wondered that he let himself be drawn into her schemes with so little resistance. Perhaps some part of him had recognised her before his conscious mind did. Perhaps the fates were up to their old tricks. Or perhaps he was simply a man deprived of feminine contacts, and she was still the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. Victoria was learning far more than she wanted about the Duke of Perrin. She had a cordial but frustrating dinner with Camden at her London hotel. The boy was slippery as an eel, and gave her elegant answers that upon further reflection contained exactly nothing of substance. After Camden left, she took herself to the theatre, where she was most enthusiastically accosted by Lady Avery and her sister, Lady Summersby, two women with whom she had the most incidental acquaintance. They were, of course, after news of Gigi. Victoria obliged. She told them that Gigi was having second thoughts. Who wouldn't? Just look at Lord Tremaine. Lady Avery and Lady Summersby concurred, the latter waving her handkerchief emphatically. Lord Tremaine was divine, simply divine. She also told them that Camden was working subtly to regain Gigi. No, not that he'd confess any such thing to her, but he did dine with her this evening, so genial of him, and she saw no hurry on his part to proceed with the divorce. In fact, the two of them were coming to visit her very soon at her cottage. Well, she wasn't obliged to tell them any truth, was she? So delighted were Ladies Avery and Summersby with the intelligence she provided that they invited her to sit in their box. Still peeved with Gigi, Victoria agreed. "We see far too little of you in town," Lady Summersby lamented halfway through the second act of Rigoletto. "I suppose it's because Devon is infinitely more beautiful."
"Our cousin lives in Devon," exclaimed Lady Avery.
"That's right," agreed Lady Summersby. "Where is he exactly?"
"Between Totnes and a little village called Stoke Gabriel," Lady Avery said.
"You must have heard of him, Mrs. Rowland. Our cousin is the Duke of Perrin." For once, Victoria wasn't certain what to say.
"Ah, yes, I might have heard of him."
"How could you not?" Lady Summersby giggled.
"Gracious me, I do miss that dear boy. Kept us busy, didn't he, in his day?
Do you remember the time he won £10,000 in one night, and lost £12,000 the next, and then won another £9,000 the third night?
Oh, yes. But he still came out £7,000 ahead, so he bought himself a new set of matched bays, and leased all of Madame Mignon's girls for a se'nnight.
What about that brawl over him between that American woman and Lady Harriet Blakely? They slapped each other like two fishwives. And then the two of them found out he was also having a liaison with Lady Fancourt.
Surely, Victoria mumbled, surely these rumours are much exaggerated.
Lady Summersby and Lady Avery exchanged a look, as if Victoria had suggested that the Prince of Wales was a lily-white virgin.
"My dear Mrs. Rowland," Lady Summersby said, every syllable drawn out for emphasis, "these are not rumours. These events happened as we pronounced, their truths as indubitable as those of the Scripture. If we wished to traffic in rumours, we'd have told you about what we've heard concerning his affair with Lady Fancutt." Lady Avery nodded gleefully. "Ropes, whips, chains, and items whose descriptions are quite beyond us, except that they are of foreign manufacture and iniquitous nature." Victoria felt slightly ill. To be sure, Gigi was no shrinking violet, but ropes, whips, chains, and those other things. Then she remembered to her horror that she still owed the Duke of Perrin an evening of gambling, just the two of them across a card table. Had he some ulterior motive other than a yen for the dubious excitement of betting? Did he mean to truss her up with her own curtain sashes and what? She whimpered. "Exactly," Lady Avery said, with no little satisfaction. "And we won't even mention the time he set Lady Wimpy's bed on fire." Chapter 14. January 1883. Gigi jerked awake in the small hours of the morning, gasping and covered in cold perspiration. In her dream, she had been running in her nightgown, chasing after something in the dark, screaming, come back to me. Was it an ill omen, this dream, or was it her conscience, festering in the dungeon of the past 3 weeks, finally breaking out of captivity and spitting mad, coming to settle the score with her? She touched the engagement ring Camden had given her. It was reassuringly snug on her finger, the gold band as warm as her own skin, the facets of the sapphire cool as silk. At the foot of her bed, Croesus snorted in his padded wicker tray. She scooted until her head was level with his. He smelled clean and warm. She took hold of one of his paws and felt some of the fear drain out of her. She let herself breathe again. All was well. And who needed a conscience when she had happiness by the bushel? Right? Hell did not begin to describe it. Camden stood at the centre of a maelstrom of joy and goodwill, drowning. The ceremony, the unending congratulations, the wedding breakfast, the flash and bang of the photographer recording the occasion for all posterity. So much laughter, so much cheer, so much genuine pleasure all around. He felt a complete fraud, a bigger fraud than she, if that was possible. Several times his will nearly broke. People were happy for him, for them. Mrs. Rowland had tears in her eyes, so did Claudia. Surrounded by a sea of tulle and organza, with Briar Meadow decked to the rafters in daffodils and tulips, as fragrant as the first day of spring, they thought it a fairy tale still, the one marriage of convenience out of thousands so fortunate as to become a blissful, devoted union. The weight of his deception choked him. It was she, in the end, who salvaged his iniquitous intentions. She with her radiance that struck him a physical blow every time he looked upon her. Every ebullient, cocksure smile from her was a little death for him. Every mirthful giggle a stab in the heart. Even so, he almost couldn't. After the reception, they travelled 15 miles to another Rowland house, nearer to Bedford, for their wedding night. The two of them alone, if one didn't count Croesus, in the oppressive confines of the brougham. Giddy and loquacious from the champagne, his new wife strategized the surprise reception that they would throw for his friends. The apartment her agent had found for them in the Quartier Latin
overlooking Rue Mouffetard, had 10 rooms. How many people did he think could fit into such an apartment? Would her governess taught French suffice for the evening's conversation? And if they served foie gras and caviar, perhaps his friends might not notice that they had hardly any furniture. Her childish enthusiasm for the life that they would never share clawed at him with a ferocity he did not want to understand. An incandescent light illuminated her eyes, a light of hope and fervour. It made her intoxicating, enchanting, beautiful. Despite everything he knew, despite the effrontery and selfishness that were the warp and woof of her corrupt femininity. He wanted to violate her then, to assert his power over her in the crudest, foulest manner, to crush her and snuff that lovely light. It would have been malevolent, but honest to a degree. He held back because of his own reciprocal corruptness. It would have been too easy for her. Shattering, yes, but shattering all at once. He didn't want that. He didn't want her to recognize the beast in him. He wanted her to panic, to despair, but to still want him, still think him the most perfect man that ever lived. That was how he would go on tormenting her after his physical departure from her life. A Baroque plan, Byzantine even, a plan that both pleased and shamed him. He awaited only the night, this one grotesque, terrible night. Camden was drinking cognac directly from a decanter when the connecting door between the bedchambers opened. He turned around and took another swig, barely feeling the fire sliding down his throat. She was swathed in a blaze of virginal white, but her hair, a great glossy mass of it, tumbled free and unbound like a cascade of the River Styx. The tips of her toes, round and pretty, peeked out from the hem of the white robe. He suddenly felt drunk. "You didn't come," she said softly, plaintively. He glanced at the clock on the mantel. It had been only a few minutes since her maid had left. "I made a bet with myself that you'd come for me first." "You made me nervous," she said, twirling one end of the silk sash that held her robe together. "I thought..." Her voice trailed off. "What did you think?" "I was afraid you might be having second thoughts." A ray of hope pierced him. If she confessed now, if she was drowning in remorse, rightfully fearful, but still courageous enough to admit what she had done and take responsibility, he would forgive her. Not in an instant, but he would. And in return, he would come clean about his own fiendish plot. "Why would you think that?" he said. He thought to himself, "Do the right thing, Gigi, do the right thing." She hesitated. For a fleeting instant, she looked conflicted and frightened. But in the next moment, she was again in control of herself, a young Cleopatra out for her own best advantage. Her eyes travelled down his person and slowly back up again. "Wedding night jitters, I suppose. Nothing more?" Instead of honesty, she had fallen back on that old cliché, feminine wiles. She thought him so stupid that he'd go on in an erotic daze and never notice that he sported an ass's head. Rage, great and raw, exploded in him. He tossed aside the decanter. In a heartbeat, he'd already covered half the distance between them. He was going to dangle her lying, scheming rump out the window until she screamed, begged, and sobbed the truth at last. She opened her robe and let it fall. Beneath the robe she wore a chemise as transparent as a water goblet, a layer of gossamer that hid nothing. He stopped and stared, his body reacting instantly. She was a pornographer's dream.
High, firm breasts, rosy nipples pointed at a man's eyes, miles of legs, and hips that flared decadently, magnificently, hips meant for a man's hard grasp as he drove himself full hilt into her. "You bitch," he thought, in a dozen languages. "You prick." That was for himself. The die was cast at last, the choice finally made. The high roads would be deserted and untrod. He had embarked on the path to purgatory. Fire blazed in the grate, but the English winter crept damp and insidious along walls and floors. He closed the distance between them. "Come to bed," he said, taking her by the wrist. "You must be cold." Beneath the pad of his index finger, her pulse raced madly. Her mind was cold and calculating, but her blood certainly ran hot. She followed him obediently and let him usher her up the stool and under the bedspread. She sat straight against a mound of pillows, the bedspread reaching only slightly past her abdomen. Her gaze flitted to him, then darted to a corner of the room. Her fingers clutched the covers. What was she afraid of now? Solomon himself could not discern Camden's ultimate goals, so eclipsed were they by the inferno of lust that threatened to flame out of control. Understanding dawned with all the gentleness of an artillery shell impact. She was nervous because she was a virgin, and this would be her first time with a man. He almost laughed. How normal, how charming, how frigging sweet. God help him. He undressed slowly, shedding honour and rectitude alongside waistcoat and shirt. Her curiosity must have prevailed over her uncharacteristic shyness, for she watched him as if he were the very miracle for which she'd spent a lifetime on her knees, devoutly praying. "Don't look at me like that," he wanted to bellow. "I am as unprincipled, disingenuous, and black-hearted as you. More, if anything. God, don't look at me like that." But she did, her eyes shining with the kind of trust and devotion that hadn't been seen since the age of chivalry. He climbed onto the treacherously soft bed on the side away from her and sat as she sat, upright, a wall of pillows behind his back, the bedspread drawn over his trousers. For once, he wished he'd debauched his way through St. Petersburg, Berlin, and Paris. His body burned with hellfire, but his mind was an abysmal blank. How did one make love, exactly, to a girl one despised with greater intensity than all the love in the world put together? She cleared her throat. "Would you, be needing a nightshirt?" He chuckled despite himself, and the answer came to him. The only way to do it was to make love to her as if the past 30 hours had never taken place, as if his heart still overflowed with optimism and tenderness. He slid a strand of her hair between his unsteady fingers. It was as cool as well water. He lifted it and pressed it to his lips, inhaling its sweet cleanness, as fragrant as a blade of young leaf.